Lena thought the drawing of Effie would be the easy one. She didn't dread it, she didn't overprepare, she sauntered in. Lena was not a saunterer, and for good reason, she decided, she always ended up regretting it.
"Where do you want to be?" Lena asked. "Your room? Your bed? Someplace else?"
Effie was painting her toenails. "Can you just do it here?" She was sitting on the floor in front of the TV in the den. Some reality show was blaring. Effie had her chin resting on her knee and was giving full attention to her toenail as though it were one of the more demanding things she'd ever grappled with.
"I guess," Lena said. "Do you mind if I turn the TV off?"
"Leave it on," Effie said. "I won't watch." Lena didn't question this. She had an instinct that bossing your model around was no way to get her to loosen up, no matter how stupid she was being. Lena settled on a profile. Effie's knees bent, her chin down, her toes flexed. She started sketching. Effie was no Valia. She moved around as though modeling for Lena's picture wasn't even on her to-do list.
"Sheesh, Eff, can you hold still?"
Effie flashed her a look. She went back to her toenails. Lena tried. She really did. It was hard to draw a moving hand. Lena let it blur. It was hard to draw someone's character when they kept their face turned away. She tried to suggest the resistance in Effie's pose. It was the only thing that felt true. And then Lena had to ask herself, why was Effie resisting so hard? It was true they'd been missing each other this summer. They'd both gotten jobs early. They'd both spent as much time away from the house as possible. Was her relationship with Effie another casualty of the Valia debacle? Had it gone more wrong than Lena knew?
"Effie?"
"What?" Effie snapped, still not turning her head. Lena's mouth seemed to work a little better with a charcoal in her hand. She opened it.
"Eff, I feel like you don't want this to work, like you're mad at me."
Effie rolled her eyes. She made a show of blowing dry the shiny pink polish on her big toe.
"Why do you think that?"
"Because you won't look at me? You won't sit still?" If Effie had been Lena and Lena had been Effie, this could have taken all day. But luckily, Effie was Effie. When she finally turned, her face was full of expression.
"Maybe I don't want you to go to art school."
Lena put down her pad.
"Why not?"
She couldn't help showing her astonishment. She always just assumed that Effie sided with her in any struggle against her parents, just as she always sided with Effie, even when Effie was wrong. Did Effie actually agree with her parents this time? Did she resent that Lena was causing more turbulence in their already turbulent home? Effie's eyes were full of tears. At long last, she capped her polish and tossed it aside.
"Why do you think?"
she demanded. Lena felt her own eyes pulling wide open.
"Eff, I don't know, please tell me."
Effie put her face in her hands.
"I don't want you to go. I don't want you to leave me here, with all of them."
On her knees, Lena made her way the few feet to her sister. She put her arms around Effie.
"I'm so sorry," Lena said honestly. "I don't want to leave you."
She felt Effie's tears against her shoulder and she held her tighter.
"I hate to even think about leaving you."
The beautiful thing about getting someone to tell you what was wrong was that you could tell them something to make it a little better. Lena made a mental note that she should try it more often. In the lobby a while later, Carmen was hugging her mom goodbye when she saw Wynn. He smiled eagerly, doubling his pace to get to her like he was afraid she might slip away.
"Carmen!"
"Hey, Wynn," she said. She couldn't help smiling at him. He was too sweet not to. Wynn and Christina were looking at each other. Wynn was probably wondering which distant relative of which distant acquaintance Carmen would be accompanying to the hospital now.
"This is my mom, Christina," Carmen said. "Mom, this is Wynn."
"Nice to meet you, Wynn," Christina said. Carmen saw him through her mother's eyes and was again struck by his exceeding gorgeousness. Carmen found most guys who looked that good intimidating, but Wynn was different. He was not arrogant or scary. He had a self-deprecating smile and a shuffling posture totally at odds with the usual "I'm gorgeous" swagger.
"Nice to meet you too," he said earnestly. "I thought you must be related. You're beautiful like Carmen." If Carmen had just heard about this statement rather than actually listening to it in person, she would have groaned and rolled her eyes and told Mr. Slick to get out of town. But hearing him say it and seeing the look on his face as he did, she believed it was the most innocent and sincere compliment she'd ever gotten. And so did her mother, apparently. Christina flushed with pleasure. "Thank you. I like to think I look like her." Carmen felt unbalanced, buffeted as she was by all the goodness. She had no idea what to say. "Carmen saved me today," Christina volunteered to Wynn, emotion all through her voice. "My husband couldn't make it to childbirth class, and Carmen came to my rescue. She's my partner and coach, can you imagine?" Christina was laughing, but her eyes were full of tears. Carmen had heard about pregnant women being extra emotional, but geez, this was a bit much. Wynn stared at Christina with rapt attention, and then he turned to look at Carmen. She'd wished many times for a boy like Wynn to look at her this way, but now it was wrong. The stuff her mom was saying made it all worse. She opened her mouth to say something, and then she realized, "Oh my God, I have to get Valia. I'm gonna be late for her." Oh God, she could practically hear the bone-splintering howl from the 8th floor. "I'll come," Christina said, running after her to the bank of elevators. "Bye, Wynn," Carmen shouted over her shoulder. He looked a little sad as she waved to him through the narrowing gap of the elevator door. As soon as it closed, Christina burst. "Nina, who is he?" She was obviously excited. He is just adorable, and the way he looked at you." Carmen's face was hot. "He does seem nice." She didn't want her mother to see her flustered smile. She wished she could get her mouth into a normal shape. "Nice? He's more than nice. How do you know him?" Carmen shrugged. "I don't really know him. Or I guess I do kind of know him." She chewed the inside of her lip. "But he doesn't know me." To the man who only has a hammer in the toolkit, every problem looks like a nail. Abraham Maslow. It took 4 evenings for Tibby to pounce on the garbage bags and take them out to the alley before Margaret could get there first. Margaret was so experienced at her job, having worked at this very Pavilion Theater for well over 20 years, and so dedicated to it that it was nearly impossible for Tibby to manage to do her coworker even this one small favor.
"Tibby, thanks," Margaret said brightly when she saw the empty cans. "You're just sweet."
"I'm returning a favor," Tibby said. Tibby watched as Margaret put her sweater in her employee locker. No pictures pinned up inside, Tibby noticed, and collected her purse in exactly the same manner she did every evening. Tibby knew Margaret would take the bus on Wisconsin Avenue to her home, which was somewhere north of here. She couldn't exactly guess what Margaret did with her free time, but she felt almost sure Margaret did it alone. Suddenly, Tibby felt inspired. "Hey, Margaret?" Margaret turned, her purse dangling neatly from the crook of her elbow. "Do you want to get some dinner with me?" Margaret looked utterly bewildered. "We could just get something quick if you want. We could go right around the corner to that Italian place." Why not spend some time with a gravely lonely person, Tibby thought, silently applauding herself. Wasn't that a worthy thing to do? Tibby felt sure it was something a good person would do. Margaret looked around as though to see if perhaps Tibby was talking to someone else. The muscles around her mouth twitched a little. She cleared her throat.
"Excuse me? Do you want to have dinner?"
Margaret looked a bit frightened.
"You and me?"
"Yes." Tibby was beginning to wonder if she had overstepped.
"Well, okay. I guess I could."
"Great." Tibby led the way around the corner. She had never seen Margaret outside the movie theater. It was kind of strange. She wondered how many times Margaret had been out of the movie theater, other than when she was home. In her pale pink cardigan, with her white vinyl purse with gold buckles, and her bewildered expression, Margaret looked like an innocent victim of some time travel mishap. "Is this place okay?" Tibby asked, holding open the door to the restaurant.
Yes,
Margaret agreed in a slightly quavering voice. Tibby had been to this restaurant before, and it had seemed perfectly normal. But now, with Margaret at her side, the place struck her as raucous, dark, nightmarishly noisy, and totally wrong. The hostess showed them to a table. Margaret perched on the very front of her chair, her backbone stiff, as though ready to flee at a second's notice.
They have good pizza, Tibby said feebly.
Did Margaret eat pizza? Did she eat anything? Margaret was terribly thin, nearly as small as a child. There were certain clues to her age, the loose skin of her neck, the texture of her blonde ponytail. Tibby knew she had to be in her mid-40s. But in almost all other respects, Margaret looked just shy of puberty. What had happened to her to make her like this? Tibby wondered. Had there been a tragedy, a loss? Was there some terrible thing that had caused her to step off the conveyor belt of life around the age of 14? Or, more insidiously, had she just taken the cautious route time and time again? Had she cut off more and more potential branches of life until it had narrowed to just one? Was Margaret scared of love? Could that be it? Had she left the building just around the time everybody else started hooking up? Tibby looked at Margaret beseechingly. She wanted to say or do something to make Margaret feel comfortable, but she could not figure out for the life of her what that might be.
Do you like pasta? Tibby asked. I've heard it's pretty good here.
Margaret looked at her menu as though it were a devilishly tricky test.
I'm not sure, she said faintly.
You could just get a salad, Tibby suggested. Or if you don't like this kind of food, I totally understand.
Margaret nodded.
Maybe a salad.
Tibby felt a stab of sadness because she knew Margaret wanted to please her too. Margaret was desperately uncomfortable, but she didn't want to let Tibby down. Who was doing whom the favor in this exercise? Slowly, the hot air of righteousness leaked out of Tibby. And she realized what an idiot she was. She had dragged poor Margaret far out of her comfort zone, congratulating herself on doing Margaret this great charity. But Tibby wasn't giving solace to a lonely woman. She was basically torturing her. What had she been thinking?
Maybe I don't feel like Italian food, Tibby said brightly, wanting only to offer Margaret some salvation. Why don't we walk back by the theater and grab some ice cream and then I'll walk you to the bus stop.
Margaret looked colossally relieved, and that gave Tibby a small piece of happiness.
Sure thing.
As they walked, Tibby remembered how her Uncle Fred had this line he brought out on the occasion of nearly all family birthdays. Her parents would moan about their children growing older, and he'd say,
"Growing up is for crap, but it's better than the alternative."
Well, for the first time, Tibby realized there was an alternative. It was walking right next to Tibby, licking her orange creamsicle and breaking Tibby's heart.
He caught me again,
Carmen told Lena, sipping her iced cappuccino and enjoying the air conditioning at the Starbucks on Connecticut Avenue.
What do you mean?
Lena asked. She wasn't eating her cookie and Carmen really wanted it.
Wynn caught me in another random act of kindness at the hospital.
Lena laughed.
Busted. I feel like I was shoplifting or something. I didn't know what to say to explain myself.
Did you tell him it was an accident? You didn't mean it? You'll never do it again as long as you live, so help you God? Carmen laughed too.
Good Carmen strikes again. What are we going to do with that girl?
Tie her up in the bathroom?
Good idea.
Lena was squinting at her and thought,
maybe you actually are good Carmen. Have you ever thought of that?
Carmen considered the way she'd knowingly polished off her mother's last coveted pint of Ben and Jerry's the night before.
Nah.
Lena still wasn't eating her cookie, so Carmen broke off a piece of it and ate it.
So, guess who's sleeping on my couch tomorrow night?
Carmen asked.
Who?
Paul Rodman. He's driving up from South Carolina and I convinced him to crash here. I haven't seen him in months. Lena shifted uncomfortably in her chair.
He asked about you.
Lena nodded timidly.
He always does. It's the part of the conversation he actually initiates.
Lena looked down at her large feet in their large cork-bottomed flip-flops. How's his dad? She asked. Carmen stopped chewing. She had been corresponding with Paul by email. She got more words out of him that way. He's not good. Paul drives hours to see him every week. It's so sad. Lena was nodding as Carmen's cell phone rang. Carmen scratched around in the bottom reaches of her bag until she found it. Hey?
Carmen, hi. It's David.
What's up? Most of the warmth in her voice evaporated.
I just wanted to thank you. The way you took care of your mother yesterday. You don't know how much it meant to her, and to me too. I wanted to be there so bad myself, and I really just can't tell you how—
It's fine, Carmen interrupted. No problem.
Really, Carmen, I really—
Okay. She didn't want him to keep going on about this. Are you still in St. Louis?
No, I'm home, he said heavily. Why was she annoyed at him?
It wasn't his fault he worked like a dog. He had a family to provide for now. He took his responsibility seriously, blah, blah, blah. So I'll see you later, she said.
Oh, Carmen, one other thing?
Yeah?
I left my phone recharger in the hotel in St. Louis. Could I borrow yours?
It was well known that they had the exact same cell phone. Sometimes it seemed like the only conversation piece between them. He had the ring that sounded like a polka. He thought it was hugely entertaining.
Sure, it's in the outlet by my night table, she said. The hotel said they'd send mine back. I told them I'm going to need it.
Why were their conversations always so stilted?
Yep, you are, Carmen said. Well, bye.
Bye. She hung up. When she put her phone back in her bag, she realized the recharger was coiled in the bottom of it.
Oh. Oops.
Lena was squinting, trying to figure out whom Carmen was talking to. David? She finally guessed.
Yeah. I knew it wasn't anybody you liked very much.
I like him all right, Carmen said, the slightest petulance creeping into her voice. She sighed.
I should be nicer, shouldn't I?
I'm not answering that. Carmen got a mischievous smile on her face.
I know what to do. I'll invite Wynne to have dinner with my mom and me and David, she laughed. That'll set him straight.
Tibby. Beach equipment and tunes. No techno crap as per discussion. B and me. Food. A lot. Mostly high-calorie snacks with extra trans fats. I think I like those. What are they anyway?
Lena. Other household goods. Kleenex in addition to toilet paper, Missy. Please make your donations, $60, and I mean cash money, to the Rehoboth Beach First Annual Pre-College Dream Weekend Fund, aka Carmen's wallet. And I mean soon, dang it.
Since Lena had heard about Paul being in town overnight, she'd been thinking of him. Finally, she got up the nerve to call him at Carmen's, and she asked him to come over. He wasn't in her family, obviously, but she felt a pressing urge to draw his picture. She didn't want to avoid him anymore. That afternoon, charcoal in hand, she met him at the door. She hugged him stiffly. She felt her heart jump a little at the way he looked. Older, sadder, even more handsome. Somewhat mutely, he followed her to the kitchen.
You two are way too much alike, Carmen said about Lena and Paul and their combined inability to carry on a conversation. Carmen had had high hopes for them once.
Do you want anything to drink? She asked him. He looked nervous.
No, thank you.
She gestured for him to sit down across from her at the kitchen table. She ran a hand through her hair. She'd brushed it for this occasion.
I have kind of a weird favor to ask of you, she said.
Now he really looked scared, but not unwilling.
Okay. Would it be all right if I drew a picture of you?
It would take around an hour or an hour and a half.
Just a sketch of you, from here up.
She indicated at her collarbone lest he run from her house in panic.
You see, I'm making a portfolio of drawings of people because I'm trying to win this scholarship to RISD. Otherwise, I can't go to art school and I really want to. Do you think that would be okay?
She had never said so much to him all at one time. He nodded.
I'd like that, he said.
She had an idea.
Maybe we'll go outside.
He followed her out to the backyard. She didn't picture him on a lounge chair by the pool or anything. she surveyed the possibilities. There was a tree stump in the far corner by the fence. It had been a giant, beautiful oak that had grown old and gotten a disease, so her parents had had it cut down before it got the chance to fall on their house. It was strong and sturdy, suitable for Paul. She steered him to it, then ran to fetch herself a chair and her drawing board. "You ready?" she asked. He sat squarely. The stump was the perfect height for him. Lena's feet would have been dangling, but his rested solidly on the soil. He put his hands on his knees. This could have looked stiff for another person, but for Paul it looked right. She noticed he wore a large gold class ring on the pinky of his left hand. It was the one thing that didn't fit. She backed up a bit. She wanted to draw more of him.
"Do you mind if I do a 3/4?
"That's fine," he said. She clipped her paper to her board. He watched her carefully. This caused her to clip her knuckle. It hurt, so she sucked on it for a second. She put her hair back in a ponytail. She poised the charcoal over her paper.
"Should I look at you?" he asked.
Yes, she said. Paul was always remarkably direct in his gaze, so this felt right for him. On the other hand, she felt the pressure building as their eyes met for long moments. She didn't feel about Paul the way she did about other people. The lines of Paul's face gave the impression of being straight and square. Strong, square jaw, square forehead, squared off cheekbones. But when she looked harder and longer, she saw many unexpectedly round things. His eyes, for instance. They were large and circular, innocent and almost childlike. But at the outside corners, she saw he had faint, fanning creases, proto-laugh lines that she suspected didn't come from laughing. And at the inside corners, the thin skin where his eyes met his nose was blue and slightly bruised-looking. His mouth was surprisingly full and curvaceous. It was a lovely mouth. She lost herself in the very tiny up-and-down lines at each corner that separated his lips from his cheeks. You wouldn't expect such a sensitive mouth on so large and strong a person. She felt a little manic looking at it boldly and for a long time. And then she felt guilty for taking advantage of this drawing opportunity in such a way. She drew his shoulders and arms in big, loose gestures. When she got to his hands, she tightened up a little. Her hand hesitated over the ring. She made herself open her mouth.
"Can I ask you about the ring?" she said.
The fingers on his other hand instantly enclosed it. He looked down. It was the first time he'd broken the pose even minutely in almost 40 minutes.
"Sorry," he said, realizing this.
"That's okay, don't worry," she said in a rush. She suddenly felt protective of him.
"You can take a break, you deserve one."
"No, that's okay." He was looking down now. His neck arched gracefully and sadly. The tilt of his neck spoke so eloquently that her fingers itched to start another drawing. It was a miracle how when you looked hard enough, when you really sought out information, there was so much to see, even in a person's tiniest gesture. There was so much feeling, such a dazzling array of things that your words, at least Lena's words, could never say. There were thousands of images and memories and ideas if you just let them come. There was the whole history of human experience somewhere contained in each of the bits. The most universal and the most specific, if you could only see it. It was like poetry. Well, she had never really found poetry in poetry, to be truthful, but she imagined this was what poetry might be like for someone who understood it and loved it. Either it was like poetry, or it was like getting really, really stoned. The ring was off, and Paul had it cradled in his palm now. He looked at her again.
"This is my father's. He went to Penn, too, so he wants me to have it."
Lena stared at him solemnly. She wondered if the swelling compassion she felt for him was finding its way out of her eyes.
"He's sick, Carmen told me."
Paul nodded.
"I'm so sorry."
He was still nodding, slowing it down.
"It's rough, you know?"
"I do," she said with feeling. "I mean, I don't. I do and I don't. I don't exactly, but I feel like I do. My boppy, my grandfather, died last summer." Suddenly she felt a horror at her words.
"Not that it's like that," she practically shouted. "Not that that is what's going to happen.
Lena really hated herself sometimes. Paul's expression was undeservedly kind. It was all sweet forgiveness and even gratitude to top it off.
I know you do, Lena. I can tell you understand.
They just stared at each other, but for the first time, the silence didn't feel shamefully insufficient. It felt okay.
Do you want to take a break? She asked him again.
Okay, he agreed this time. The stump was big enough for two. She sat next to him cross-legged. She leaned into him a little and he let her. The sun shone down on them benevolently. The corners of her drawing where she left it in the grass flapped gently in the breeze. She wanted to finish it, but she didn't feel rushed. She realized she'd begun the drawing so she could tell Paul she was sorry.
Jiggle it a little. It'll open.
Pinky in the brain.
It was another day in the rut. Valia had used up most of her energy IMing her friends back home. It was the one time of the day she looked alive. Now they sat in the darkened den, Carmen preparing to wage another war of attrition with the TV as the prize. She hadn't gotten her Ryan Hennessy fix in days. She tried to picture him. For some reason, she couldn't picture him. She stood up.
Valia, we're festering. We have to get out of here.
We do?
We do. It's a beautiful day. We need a walk. Valia looked sleepy and cranky.
I'm watching a show. I don't want to walk.
Please? Carmen suddenly felt so desperate she didn't care about their standoff of sullenness. Let Valia win this round.
I'll do all the work. You just sit in your chair.
Valia considered. She liked being pled with. She liked her obvious power over Carmen. She shrugged.
It's too hot.
It's not so hot today. Please?
Valia wouldn't give Carmen the satisfaction of saying yes outright, but she looked at her wheelchair with resignation. Carmen took the opening. Gently, she heaved Valia's skinny body into her wheelchair.
Okay.
Carmen checked for her keys and her money and wheeled Valia right out the door. The sky was perfectly blue. Though it was August, the swampy, deep summer haze had momentarily lifted. It was so good to be out. Carmen walked aimlessly, letting her mind wander. She tried to look at the world through Valia's eyes, to imagine how each suburban vista looked through the eyes of an old woman who had spent her life on an Aegean island. Not so good, obviously. But when Carmen looked up and saw the sky, she knew it was the same sky. She wondered if Valia saw this lovely azure sky and knew it was her same sky. For some reason, a picture pushed into Carmen's mind of a restaurant she'd been to with her mom a few times. She didn't remember the name of it, but she knew exactly where it was. She pointed them in the direction of it and walked. She felt hungry all of a sudden. At the restaurant, Carmen was pleased to see they still had tables with large white umbrellas set up outside. Red geraniums flowed from wooden boxes along the whitewashed walls of the little terrace. Carmen had never been to Greece, but she imagined that if you just looked at a small patch of the wall or looked up at the white umbrella against the sky, maybe it would look a little like this. She set Valia up at a table. There were no other diners.
Why are we here? Valia demanded.
I need a rest, and I'm also kind of hungry. Do you mind?
Valia looked annoyed, but martyred.
Does it matter if I mind?
I'll be right back, Carmen promised.
They didn't have waiter service at the cafe tables, so she went to order from the counter inside. It was after lunch and before dinner, so the place was pretty deserted. She felt a bit illicit as she studied the menu. It wasn't Greek food precisely, but it was Mediterranean. She recognized a lot of the dishes from things she'd had at Lena's house. She knew the Kaligarises weren't cooking that stuff at the moment. Lena explained that her dad thought it made Valia homesick. He tried to steer her away from everything that might make her homesick. He didn't want Valia cooking, even though it was what she had done her whole life. Carmen ordered stuffed grape leaves and something hot that strongly resembled spanakopita. She ordered an eggplant dish, a Greek salad, a few squares of baklava, and two large lemonades. She paid up and carried it all to the table, setting all the dishes between her and Valia.
I bought us a snack. I hope that's okay.
Valia gazed at it all disdainfully. Carmen put a steaming spinach pastry on a little paper plate and handed it to Valia with a fork.
Here, try some.
Valia just sat there with it, smelling it, completely still. Immediately, Carmen regretted her impulse, just as she ended up regretting almost all of her impulses. Valia didn't want to be here. She was going to hate the inauthentic food. She could already hear Valia's litany of complaints.
You call this food? What is the green mess? This is not spinach.
As the moments passed, Carmen felt worse and worse. Why did she have such stupid ideas? More than that, why did she actually carry them out? Valia held the plate up close to her face. She looked like she was going to take a bite, and then she stopped. Carmen watched in wonderment as Valia put it down on the table and bent her head. Valia just sat like that with her head bent for many long moments. And then Carmen saw the tears. Lines of tears bumped down Valia's wrinkly face. Carmen felt her own throat constricting. She watched as Valia's face slowly collapsed into pure sorrow. Carmen was up and out of her chair. Without thinking, she went to Valia and put her arms around the old lady. Valia was stiff in Carmen's arms. Carmen waited to be pushed away or for some other signal of Valia not wanting to be hugged anymore, especially not by Carmen. But instead, Valia's head got heavier as it sank into Carmen's neck. Carmen felt the soft, saggy skin against her collarbone. She hugged a little harder. She felt Valia's tears damp on her neck. She realized, sort of distantly, that Valia's hand had made its way to her wrist. How sad it was, Carmen thought, that you acted awful when you were desperately sad and hurt and wanted to be loved. How tragic, then, the way everyone avoided you and tiptoed around you when you really needed them. Carmen knew this vicious predicament as well as anyone in the world. How bitter it felt when you acted badly to everyone and ended up hating yourself the most. Carmen tenderly patted Valia's hair, surprised that for once it wasn't she who was acting awful. It wasn't Carmen who was being needy, but rather feeling needed. She thought about Mr. Caligaris and all of his theories about protecting his mother. Yes, smelling Greek food made Valia sad, he was right about that, and being held by another human seemed to make her sad too. But sometimes, Carmen knew, being sad was what you had to do.
I want to go home, Valia croaked into Carmen's ear.
I know,
Carmen whispered back, and she understood that Valia wasn't talking about 1303 Highland Street, Bethesda, Maryland.
Have fun with Michael, Bridget lifted her eyebrows suggestively, but not too much fun.
As she helped Diana put her duffel bag into her car, Bridget felt a strange rolling sensation under her eyeballs. Her head was aching, and she was tired. She was happy for Diana that she was going back to Philadelphia to spend the weekend with her boyfriend, and she was sorry for herself that she was staying here. She decided against stopping in the dining hall. Friday night dinner was one of the better meals, involving an ice cream sundae buffet where she was always happy to return for seconds and thirds. But tonight, she wasn't hungry. I gotta go to bed, she muttered to herself, trudging through the parking lot and past the equipment sheds. The camp felt strangely empty. It was middle weekend, so the vast majority of campers went home. Only about a quarter of the staff remained to keep an eye on things. As she pulled off her clothes and crawled under her covers, Bridget was grateful that her cabin was quiet for once. She bundled herself up as tight as she could. It was at least 80 degrees outside. Why was she so cold? The tighter she bundled, the colder she felt. She was shaking. Her teeth were chattering. The more she focused on it and tried to stop, the more they chattered and clacked. Her cheeks burned. She was getting a fever, she concluded. She meant to do something about this. Maybe she could steal a couple of Advil from Katie. She kept imagining herself doing this without actually doing it. She passed gradually into a state between awake and asleep. She imagined getting another blanket. She imagined drinking a glass of water. She could not figure out whether she was doing it or not. She puzzled and tortured her brain, trying to figure out what was and wasn't real. She must have drifted like that for a long time because it was dark when she was startled by the presence of somebody next to her.
B?
She tried to orient herself. It was Eric's face floating near hers.
Hi,
she said softly. She didn't want to pull the blankets from around her chin because she hated the idea of a draft reaching her hot skin.
Are you okay?
I'm okay, she said. Her teeth were chattering again. He looked worried. He pressed his hand to her forehead. God, you're hot.
She meant to laugh and make a joke about this, but she couldn't summon it. She was too tired.
I think I got the flu.
You got something.
Tenderly, almost automatically, he pushed her hair back from her forehead. It was so nice how he did it. She felt strangely cozy and happy inside her fever. He moved his hand to touch her flushed cheek. His hand felt remarkably cold.
Do you want to take something? Should I see if the nurse is around?
His eyes were fixed on her, full of concern.
Don't worry, it's not a big deal.
Her fatigue made her talk extra slow.
I always run high fevers. My mom used to say,
she had to take a break to work her energy back up.
I'd get to 106 degrees with just a little cold.
She didn't mean to sound tragic when she said this, but she must have, because Eric looked distraught. He knew about her mother. She had told him almost the first time they'd met.
I'm not sure if the nurse is here, but I'm gonna get you something. Do you take Tylenol or Motrin or something like that?
Anything, she said.
I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere, okay? Promise?
She coughed up a tiny laugh. That I can promise.
You have to let Valia go home,
Carmen said to Ari, following her into the Caligaris' kitchen. First, she'd had to get Lena's blessing. Then it had taken Carmen 2 days to get Ari alone in a room, but Carmen was nothing if she wasn't dogged. Ari put the mail down on the kitchen counter and turned to Carmen in surprise.
I'm sorry?
Ari's eyes were large and lovely like Lena's, but dark and indefinable, where Lena's were fair, green, and fragile.
I know it's none of my business, Carmen backtracked, and I know you and Mr. Caligaris probably don't want to hear my opinion.
Carmen always called Ari Ari, and she always called Mr. Caligaris Mr. Caligaris. She couldn't remember a time when it was different. Ari nodded slightly, inviting her to pursue that unwanted opinion.
I really think that you and Mr. Caligaris should let Valia go back to Greece.
Tears welled in Carmen's eyes, and she felt so annoyed by her ready-to-wear emotions.
She's dying here.
Ari sighed heavily and rubbed her eyes with the backs of her hands. At least this wasn't entirely news to her.
How can Valia take care of herself, especially now with her knee? Who is going to look out for her if not us?
She didn't sound like she was voicing her own conviction, but more like she was reciting somebody else's.
Her friends? She has her friends, and they are like her family. I can understand that. The only time I've ever seen her look happy is when she's IMing Rena.
Carmen kneaded her hands, sort of amazed to hear herself take on Ari like another adult.
Valia is too depressed to get herself a glass of water, but I swear she could have programmed the computer herself if it meant making a connection to home.
Ari looked at her, pained and tired, but with tenderness too. Couldn't Ari see that Valia wasn't the only one suffering? Carmen had never seen Ari so tense, and Mr. Caligaris hadn't always been as angry and rigid as he was now. Couldn't Ari see the toll it took, not only on her, but also on her daughters? Carmen knew she wouldn't have been able to have this conversation if Mr. Caligaris were there, but she trusted Ari to love her. Ultimately, she trusted Ari to read her good intentions and hopefully the truth.
Carmen, sweetheart, I am not saying you aren't right. I appreciate what you are trying to do, but it's complicated. Really, how can Valia go back to that house she shared with Bapi for 57 years? How could she tolerate the pain of living there without him? Sometimes change is the right thing.
Carmen couldn't help looking sour. She was no friend of change.
I know that. I know being back in her house on the island will make her sad. Of course she'll be sad.
but that's her home. That's her life. She can handle being sad, I'm sure of that. What she can handle is being here.
There was that law of life, so cruel and so just, that one must grow, or else pay more for remaining the same. Norman Mailer. Tibby couldn't fall asleep. She sat in her bed and looked out the window at the hazardous apple tree. The apples were growing plump and red now. How had she never even tried one? She associated them with having fallen, that was part of it. She could viscerally recall the smell of the oversweet, rotting, fermenting apples from seasons past that fell without ever being picked. That smell and the sight of the marauding worms and beetles nauseated her. She loathed the apples wounded on the ground, but she had never thought to pick one from a branch. The tree seemed to be considering her just as she considered it. She felt its judgment. It wasn't judging her for leaving the window open, that wasn't her crime. Her crimes were deeper and more numerous. She wasn't big enough to love Catherine as Catherine deserved. She wasn't brave enough to love Brian as he deserved. She wasn't strong enough to keep the things she loved alive, Bailey, Mimi, nor was she wise enough to grasp the meaning of their deaths. Tibby was good at hiding. It was the one thing she knew how to do. She was good at sealing herself in a little box and waiting it out. But waiting for what? What was she waiting for? She thought she'd learned a lesson from Catherine's fall out the window. The lesson was, don't open, don't climb, don't reach, and you will not fall. But it was the wrong lesson. She had learned the wrong lesson. The real lesson embodied in Catherine's 3-year-old frame was the opposite. Try, reach, want, and you may fall, but even if you do, you might be okay anyway. Flexing her feet under the covers, Tibby thought of a corollary to this lesson. If you don't try, you save nothing because you might as well be dead. Time passed for Bridget in the strangest way, a little forward, a little back. She was vaguely aware of Katie and Allison returning to the cabin. They probably assumed she was asleep, but that didn't stop them from flipping on the light and gabbing noisily and turning on music. She suspected they'd been partying with the other remaining staff. They smelled like it anyway. Sometime after that, Eric returned. He sized up the situation with Katie and Allison. He was furious.
Can't you see that B is sick? Why are you making all this noise? What the hell's wrong with you?
Even through her haze, Bridget could tell this was not a side of Eric she'd seen before.
Dude, back off, Katie snapped. Why are you barging into our cabin and telling us what to do?
She was too drunk to yield her ground, even if B was sick. Eric knelt next to Bridget. He put his hand on her forehead again. He bent down close to her ear.
I don't really want to leave you in here with the two of them. You want to come back with me? My cabin is empty this weekend. You can sleep.
She nodded gratefully. She was only wondering how she was going to get from here to there without freezing to death. She wasn't wearing anything but her underwear under the blankets. He had an idea for that, too. He put his arms under her and scooped her up, still tucked inside her blankets. He carried her out of the cabin and into the night, with Katie and Allison watching his back in surprise and indignation. She felt light in his arms. She rested her burning face against his neck. She was shivering again. He pulled the blankets closer around her and rested his chin lightly on the top of her head. She was trying her hardest to remember each of these things he did, to mark them in her brain permanently, because they were immeasurably sweet. Maybe they were the sweetest things that had ever happened to her or ever would. She kept hoping that this, unlike all those blankets she imagined getting and glasses of water she imagined drinking, that this was real.
Please let it be real, she thought wistfully. And if it's not, let me just stay here anyway.
He pushed open the door of his cabin with his back and put her very gently into a bed. His bed, she hoped. She wanted to smell his smell. He was careful to tuck her blankets around her snugly. She tried to stop shivering.
I'd put another blanket on you, but I don't want you to get overheated, you know?
She nodded. She noticed he'd been carrying a bag also, looped around his wrist.
Here.
He unloaded a bottle of Advil, a bottle of aspirin, a bottle of water, a bottle of orange juice, a thermometer, and a paper cup.
The nurse isn't back till Sunday, but I got into the infirmary in case we need anything else.
She fluttered her eyes, trying to focus on his solemn face.
It was unlocked?
He shrugged.
Now it is.
He filled the cup with water and poured two pills into his palm.
Ready?
He helped her to sit up in bed. She tried to figure out how to get her hand out without letting any cold air in. She stuck her hand out by her neck, keeping the rest of the blanket tight around her. She thirstily drank the water, and another cup, and another with her little T-Rex arm.
Poor thing, you were thirsty, he said.
She took the pills, wincing as they went down. Her throat felt swollen.
Thank you, she said, lying back down.
She felt tears fill her eyes at the extravagance of his kindness to her. He put his cool hand on her cheek again.
I am worried about you, he said quietly.
And looking at his face, she could never again question whether they had really become friends. He took the thermometer out of its case.
Open up.
Are you sure you want to know? She asked. She knew she was hot. He nodded, so she opened her mouth. He waited for the mercury to settle. It didn't take very long. He studied it with his eyebrows furrowed.
God, it's 104.7. Is that safe?
I've been there before, she said faintly. Why did she have to do everything in such dramatic fashion?
Should I call a doctor? He asked.
I think I'm gonna be okay, she answered truthfully. I'm not scared or anything. He lay on the bed opposite her, propped on his side, watching her carefully.
I'm going to call your dad,
he announced, sitting up. He got his cell phone from the top drawer of his bureau. Don't call my dad, she said softly. He's not there.
It's midnight. Where would he be?
No, I mean, she took a break. He's just not there in that way. She was too tired to explain any better. He looked at her, the corners of his mouth turned down. He looked deeply troubled about that. He lay down across from her again. The more she wanted to stop shivering, the more she shivered. She didn't want him to worry about her. He couldn't stand to watch her shake. He got up and came over to her. He picked her up inside her ball of covers and moved her over on the bed. To her great astonishment and joy, he lay down alongside her. He put his arms around her and tucked her face into his neck, and she felt as though her fevered heart might burst. He held her as though he thought he could absorb her fever and her sickness and her sadness at not having a mother or even a father she could count on. He stroked her hair and lay with her like that for hours. And maybe he did absorb her ache, because in his arms, she finally fell asleep. By 4 a.m., daylight was beginning to haunt the sky. Tibby did not want the sun to rise without some real measure of awakening. After these hours, she felt as though she knew the tree in a new way, and the tree knew her. It wasn't an unfriendly tree, but it did pose a challenge to her. Somewhere around 2 o'clock, Tibby had remembered she had the traveling pants. They had been sitting for a shameful number of days under her bed. She'd been hiding from them. Somewhere around 3, she put them on. She hoisted up the window sash and sat with her elbows on the sill, resting her chin in her hands. The tree waved. Catherine had thought she could reach it from the window, but in fact she couldn't. Tibby could reach it, but thought she couldn't. Tibby's mother's ovaries seemed to produce a hardier strain of egg as they got older. Tibby put one foot out the window and then the other. She sat on the sill. She looked down. It was far. She would feel incredibly stupid if she fell. She and Catherine could wear matching hockey helmets. Tibby smiled in spite of herself, knowing what a huge kick that would give Catherine. She wondered if Nikki would be similarly willing to help with the stickers. Tibby caught a sturdy branch with two hands and held it tight. She knew just where she needed to put her feet. She tried to figure out how to do it so that her weight would not at any time be up for grabs. Then she remembered that this was kind of the point. When she hoisted herself off the window, she would have to transfer her weight completely to her hands for a second or two until she could place her feet. She would just have to do that.
Okay.
Yes.
Like, now?
Tibby looked at the ground. She could already see a couple of wormy apples languishing in the dark grass. The ground was psyching her out, so she looked at the sky. She lifted. She swung. She actually screamed in that moment. But before her scream had gotten all the way out of her mouth, her feet were on the lower branch. She was balanced. She was safe. She passed herself down slowly, branch by branch. She had a bit of the monkey in her after all. She hung from a low branch by both hands, skimming above the ground with her feet. Then she let go. The fall was small, but it was grand. Her hands hurt like crazy. Her whole body was shaking with nervousness and pleasure. Her chest was so full she could barely fit a breath into it. She felt like she was living someone else's life. She crept around the house to let herself in the front door. Before she even turned the knob, she realized it would be locked. And so would the back door, and so would the side door. She was locked out of her house. This struck her as so unbearably funny that she rolled around on the grass and laughed until she cried. Sometime toward morning, Bridget's fever broke. As dramatically as it had gone up, it came down. She was hardly aware of what was happening when the air around her suddenly turned from bone cold to sweltering hot. The sweat seemed to pour from every inch of her skin. When she awoke with a start, she realized she had thrown off all her covers in her sleep. More alarmingly, she was lying in her underwear, still circled in the arms of Eric's sleeping body. Now she was afraid to move. Whether B was sick or not, this would not look good to Kaya, for example. She didn't want Eric to wake up and see how it was. She thought she could very carefully untangle the sheet from the bottom of the bed and cover herself with it before he woke up. She was feeling remarkably lucid as she grasped the edge of the sheet between the first and second toes of her left foot. Moving as slowly and smoothly as she could, she pulled her foot toward her. How funny and strange that she and Eric had slept in the same space twice in less than 2 weeks, and not for having chosen it, not for having wanted to sleep together at all. Well, maybe she did, but no longer at his expense. In a way, it was a tragic waste, and in a more profound way, it was the most romantic thing she had ever experienced. 2 years ago, they had slept together in the figurative sense. This summer, in the literal one. The former had split her in two, and the latter made her feel whole. The first summer had made her feel abandoned. This made her feel loved. Sex could be a blissful communion, but it could also be a weapon, and its absence sometimes was required for the establishment of peace. Eric shifted, and she halted her foot abruptly. Still asleep, he pulled her closer so her whole self was pressed against him, his arms and chest against her bare skin. He sighed. He probably dreamed she was Kaya. She also dreamed she was Kaya, the one he truly loved. Bridget wanted to enjoy this, but she couldn't. She couldn't bear to think of him waking up and feeling embarrassed and compromised after he had cared for her with such perfect kindness. She wanted to protect him from that. She waited until his breathing sank into a rhythm again, and she started back up with the sheet. Morning was almost fully upon them, and the sun was streaming through the window, illuminating their twined bodies. "Don't wake up yet," she begged him. She had gotten the sheet almost up to her thighs when he awoke. "Oh." For a moment, in that transition, he clung to her hard, and then, in stages, he seemed to recognize the yellow hair spread over his arms and to realize who it was he held like that. Confused, he looked at her full on, at the two of them together, and then he looked away.
I'm sorry, he muttered, pulling his arms from her. How she missed them. She pulled the sheet up over herself. The bedding under her was soaked with sweat. Please don't say that, she said. Bridget had always believed that the night was more dangerous than the day, but in the preceding 12 hours, her conviction had reversed itself. The night protected her, and the morning laid her bare.
I didn't mean,
he began flustered. I know, she said quickly. He couldn't look at her anymore.
Are you feeling
so much better, she supplied. He was up on his feet, turned away from her.
I'll let you get dressed. Grab anything you want to mind, t-shirt or whatever.
He pulled a pair of shorts over his boxers. There were so many things she wanted to say to him, so many shades of the words thank you, so many routes to get to an apprehension of love. Not that kind of love, this kind of love, any kind of love, really. She wanted to say these things to him, to make him understand her feelings, and also to make him know that, though this thing between them was fragile and strange, she knew, she really knew it was, he was safe. But it was too late. He was already gone. This telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us. Western Union Internal Memo, 1876. Mom? Carmen strode into her mother's room and toward the closed door of her bathroom. Hey, are you okay in there? Carmen was nervous to begin with because her mom had stayed home from work, explaining she was a little under the weather. Carmen had made her scrambled eggs for breakfast and Christina had only picked at them. Christina had been in there a long time. Carmen heard a moan and then nothing. Mama? She knocked on the bathroom door. Is everything all right? She felt her heart pounding. When her mother opened the door a moment later, her face was white. Mama, what's going on? Even Christina's lips were white.
I'm not sure.
She put her hand on the doorframe to steady herself.
I think my water broke.
You do? Carmen felt like she'd been transported to one of those old-fashioned movies where the wife goes into labor, only in this version, Carmen was the bumbling husband.
I think so.
Does that mean? Christina transferred both hands to her spherical stomach.
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm in labor.
It's too early, Carmen shouted at her mother's stomach as though the baby should know better. The baby isn't due for 4 more weeks.
Nena, sweetie, I know.
Should I call the hospital?
I'll call my midwife, Christina said.
She walked slowly toward the phone.
Do you feel okay?
Carmen asked, watching her mother call.
I feel like I'm leaking.
Christina pushed a button and waited. She waited longer while the receptionist paged her midwife. Carmen paced while Christina alternately talked and listened. When she hung up, she looked scared, and that pushed Carmen's heart from a trot to a canter.
What?
Christina's eyes were teary.
I have to go to the hospital to get checked. If my water really broke, I have 12 hours to go into labor naturally, and after that they induce. The fear of me getting an infection is bigger than worrying about the baby being early. So the baby is coming?
Yes, soon, Christina said faintly. Where is David? Carmen asked. It was obviously the thing Christina was thinking about.
He's...
Christina put her hands over her face. She was trying not to cry, and that made Carmen feel worse.
I'm trying to think. He's been away so much. I think he's in Trenton, New Jersey. Maybe he's in Philadelphia now, I'm not sure.
We'll find him, Carmen shouted, further alarming them both. We'll call him.
First, we'll go to the hospital, okay? The midwife said go right over.
Carmen's hands were clammy, and she raced around ineffectively. Have you got your bag? I'll drive. Once in the car, Carmen watched her mother intently.
Nena, honey, keep your eyes on the road. I'm okay.
Are you having... Carmen wasn't sure what the right terminology was, having diligently tuned it out most of the summer. Labor?
Christina kept her hands on her stomach, her eyes vague, as though she were feeling for some message tapped in Morse code from within.
No, I don't think so.
Does anything hurt? Carmen asked.
Not really. My back is cramping, but it's just uncomfortable, not really painful.
Once they were at the hospital, and Carmen had landed her mother with a resident to get checked out in an examining room on the labor and delivery floor, she called David's cell phone. It went right to his voicemail without even ringing. That wasn't a great sign. She left a message for him. She meant to sound calm, mature, and informative, but as soon as she hung up, she knew she sounded more like semi-hysterical. She shot up at the sight of her mother's face at the door of the waiting room.
What?
Carmen said softly, inwardly screaming at herself to be calm.
My water did break, Christina said.
She looked overwhelmed, her voice was quiet, and she was clearly scared.
Okay. I'm not in labor, though.
That's good, right?
Yes.
So now what? We go home?
I have to stay here, Christina said. They want to keep an eye on me until 8 tonight, then they'll induce.
Induce means like...
They give you chemicals to make you go into labor.
Carmen nodded solemnly.
But I told them we can't do it until... I can't have the baby until...
Carmen watched in agony as the tears brewed in Christina's eyes.
I can't do it until David gets here.
The tears spilled over, and Carmen pulled her mother into her arms. Christina let herself cry for real, and Carmen wondered if this had ever happened before in her whole life. Christina always took her mothering so seriously, she hardly ever let herself cry or act scared in front of Carmen. Carmen felt scared too, but at the same time she felt grown up. She felt proud that her mother was letting Carmen take care of her this time. Holding her mother, Carmen wanted, really wanted to be brave this time.
I'm going to go get David, Carmen promised her. I'm going to get him and bring him home so you can have the baby together, okay?
Carmen sat in the hospital lobby trying to calculate. The timing was bad on almost every front. Grandma Carmen, Christina's mother, was still in Puerto Rico with her aunt. Everybody, David included, was getting travel engagements out of the way in time for when the baby arrived. But the baby apparently had little consideration for anyone else's plans. Carmen was beginning to wonder if this baby was going to have a few things in common with its big sister. Carmen couldn't leave her mother alone while she got David. It could take a while. Her mother was not yet in labor.